And I made it 3 months, almost 3 months, and then they, the nicer way to say it is they told me that I needed to get out and figure something else out myself. I did a little bit of too much women, too much trying to get loaded in there, and then, you know, I was back in the street. And at the same time, I had this court case going on the whole time, and my mind's thinking, like, your life revolves around getting loaded. Why aren't you loaded right now? You know, I had that obsession of the mind. I was obsessing really hard. So you know what? I get loaded. I went to do an outpatient program because I needed to complete something. So I go to this outpatient program, and the second I get there, they all knew I was high. They all knew I was wrong. They were like, we're keeping you. We're keeping you. You can't even. There's no such thing as outpatient for you. You're staying. I was like, great, I can stay in another rehab. You know, it's just like, it's all good. And, I mean, I tend to get stuck on certain tasks, so I didn't do the things that I was supposed to do again. And next thing you know, I was kicked out, asked to leave. They told me to go figure it out yourself. They wanted me to go to a year-long program in Los Angeles. And I kind of laughed at them, and I told them, you know what, I'll pack up my stuff. I'll figure it out myself. And, you know, I tried to say, couch surfing for a little while. I tried bumming off everybody I could, but, you know, it got really bad. And I was like, fuck it, I'll go to L.A. My phone rang, and it was this guy who ran this rehab that he kicked me out. He said, you know what, if you want one more chance, we have a sober living in L.A., and if you want to go there, I'll have to pick you up right now. And, you know, that was the start to my sobriety. I spent the first year of my sobriety in Los Angeles.
Oh, what?
L.A. Yeah. A lot of you guys got to kind of hold it down because it looks like Long Beach is resting pretty hard in here. But, you know, and I got to L.A., they told me to get a sponsor. You know, they told me you need to work steps. They told me you need to get commitment. So I was like, whatever, I'll get the police off my back. And, you know, I had 2 weeks sober, and I went to court, and I'm sitting in court, and thank God for confidentiality, but the judge looked at my sheet, he saw that I went to the one rehab, he saw I went to the other rehab, you know, and he didn't know I got kicked out. Next thing you know, I get deferred entry of judgment, they wash everything away, and I'm like a free man. So my first thought is, am I going back out? Like, should I leave this place? What should I do right now? And from there on, you know, I said, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot. And they told me, you know, now that you have to do your own thing, go get a job. And I had this big ego, and I only had like 4 months later, and I walked down, you know, I was like, I'll get a job anywhere. Walked to the biggest, most busiest Bank of America in West L.A. Walked in, asked for the boss, sat down with her, I said, you know what, you're going to hire me, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in the bank, and these people are sliding me a box of cash, and they're like, you're going to be a teller, here's 50 grand. If you need more money, write it down on a piece of paper. I started looking around, I was like, these people are crazy, they have no idea who I am. They do not know what's going on right now. And you know what, I did great at that job, and I got a little promotion, and they put me on the floor, and then one day I get called in, and my boss is like, yeah, you need to come into the office. So I'm thinking I'm going to get fired, I'm wondering what I did wrong. And she slipped me a little piece of paper, and it had 6 numbers on it. And I was like, what's going on here? And she said, you know what, she's like, you're going to be on the floor, but the tellers need more money. You need to go in the back, and you need to get money out of the vault and give them the money. Next thing you know, I'm looking around at all the cameras in the bank, and I thought I was on Candid Camera, and Ashton Kutcher was going to, like, pop out and be like, you're pumped, I got you. Like, you know, because that stuff doesn't happen to me. But I realized that, you know, that's where my life was. I'm not that person that I used to be. I'm not like that anymore. I finally found a way to live life sober, and life can be good. But I still didn't understand the whole disease thing. I didn't understand that I was supposed to, that I have a deadly disease and I can die. And my sponsor that I had, I got one just because I was supposed to have one, you know, check them off the list. I got the sponsor, and he told me to meet him at Cedar Sinai Hospital in L.A., and I went there, and his mom had cancer. And we're in the hospital, and she's doing chemo, and we're walking up and down the hallway. And he's like, dude, he's like, take a minute and look in every one of these rooms. He's like, every single person in here is dying, and they're fighting for their lives. They have deadly disease that's going to kill them. And he's like, and you know what? You have the same fucking thing as them, but here's a solution. He handed me a big book, and he told me, you know what? If you do 12 things in here, or a dozen things, it'll save your life. He's like, if I could give this to every single person in here, they'd be on it right now. And he's like, you know what? You need that. You have a fighting chance, so why don't you do it? And I got that. I understood that. I was like, okay, let's do it. Let's go. I'm on for the ride. You know what? My life got really good, really fast, and I didn't have that gift of desperation that everybody talks about. I just gave it a chance. So if you think that, like, oh, I don't have this gift of desperation, so I might as well go back out, like, that's bullshit. Just try it. See what happens. hear a lot of people say, meetings give the year. I gave the year. My life got really good really quick, and I fucking love it. And you know what? I got, people always say that they're scared of the four step, right? And I did my four step, everything was fine, and then I got to my events, and it made me a little nervous. And you know, I had 6 months sober, and the guy who called me and sent me to that that sober living who kicked me out of his rehab, I met up with him and I made amends to him. And you know, we talked, and he told me, just keep doing what you're doing, which a lot of people always say. And he said, you know what, maybe one day I'll give you a job. And I totally blew him off. You know, he was another check off the list. Like, I did what I had to do. I made amends to him. And then I had like about 11 and a half months sober. And I wasn't really feeling the job at the bank. It wasn't me. I thought I could help people. I wanted to do something else. My phone rings, and it's the same guy. And, you know, I was the guy who was the biggest pain in his ass, the biggest piece of shit. And then the next thing you know, he called me, and he said, do you still not like your job at the bank? And I was like, I'm not really feeling it. He said, put your 2 weeks in, and you can come down and work for me. And, you know, I've been working there ever since. And I love my job. I love my life. And everything is just, like, about me being able to do what I can to help other people. And I love doing that. I mean, that's what we all do in one way or another. That's what this program's here for. And, you know, I moved back down to the desert. I came to work at this place, and I hadn't seen my mom for a long time. And I saw her a few times here and there, and I went and I had dinner with her with one of my friends. And, you know, when we're out there getting loaded, we always do a few nice things here and there, because we all have hearts, you know. We do what we can. But it's basically all about me. But if I can do something here or there, I'll do it. And I bought her this bracelet. And you know what, I got this bracelet, and I gave it to her a long time ago when I was getting high, and when I was getting drunk, and she took the bracelet, and I totally forgot about it. We're sitting at dinner, and she grabbed my hand, and she told me, you know what, I've been wearing this bracelet ever since you left, and I was just hoping that one day I would get my son back, you know, and this bracelet is turning to wrist green, it's like super green shit. But that meant up to me, and I'm like, really people out here who care about me, you know, and what I did was, I went out and I found that exact same bracelet. I got platinum on. I saved up my money. I mailed it away. I got engraved on it, I love you, Mom. You know, and I went and I saw her and I made amends to her and I gave her this gift. And just to see the tears coming down her eyes and the hug that she gave me, that was the feeling I've always been looking for. We all like to feel good, you know. We don't have to do it with alcohol. We don't have to do it loaded. We can do it just by being with other people. You know, and that's how my life is. And if you're new and you're still confused and you're like, why is this guy still talking out there? It's okay. Give us a little bit of time because I did it. It worked. And if I'm up here sober, anybody can be sober. So, I mean, I'm glad you guys could have me on. I hope everybody has a good night. Thank you.
I cried again. He was nervous. I don't understand why, that was great. Now, I would like to introduce our main speaker tonight, Allison M. from Sahuayita, Arizona. I'm Allison, I'm an alcoholic. I love that. I'm nervous, and then it's the most articulate stream of consciousness. Like, it's all good. Thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for your share. I'm glad that you're here, and welcome to the newcomer and all of the newcomers. And that little girl, I double dog dare you to come get some of these, this little roll of women that I got up here. They're rolled out these. Get their phone number before you leave this meeting tonight. And there's one in the back over there. Her name's Doria. I want you to go talk to her.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful. Yeah. Oh, I'll call you. I am very grateful to be here tonight, and thank you so much to the committee and to Christina Sassy for asking me to come. I just come to YPOD just to hear the newest thing that you add on to the, you know, like, My very first committee on WIPA was Indianapolis, Alcoholics Anonymous, Young People's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had a bid in for ICIPA, and that was in 1989. And we didn't get it, but I've been a part of Los Angeles and all these different, you know, Sacramento. They didn't give it to us either because we burnt down the hotel room completely. So, you know, like, over and over, so, like, you know, and then the next thing, like, winning, you know, that's added on now because you know who would love that. You know, I call my sponsor before I always, you know, do this, and we talk about the real deal, and I've been going through it. This has been an interesting period of time in my sobriety, and, you know, sometimes it's not, you know, I get up and I'm like, what, I don't know, I might just sit down and cry for the whole, like, meeting. It'll be awesome for you. Things like, you know, just go and tell them that you're 22 years sober and you have an open heart and you're in life on life terms. You know, that's what you say. And then I talked to my sister, and my sister's also in sobriety. She just turned 22 in October. And, and she said, yeah, you know, go save lives. Make sure you talk for 2 hours about humility. You know. So I get both sides of that, you know, the heckle and all that stuff. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the countdown. There used to be a time that I'd be in the meeting seeing who stood up when so I could see if I could dance with them later. It was always the sickest bastard in the back room that I'd seen smoking, you know, that guy, like, across the room, and saw him smoking and waited for the countdown so I could see, you know, yeah, no. 30 days sober. And then my best friend said, why don't you share about the time that you punched a hole through the wall when you were 15 years sober? Or followed that newcomer to prison. I'll share what it looks like. And how far I've come. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time when I was 13 years old, and it was in the first institution that I was placed in, and I asked to go to that meeting so I could get off the lockdown unit, and that was the only motive. I didn't know what this was about, I didn't know why you guys were there, I didn't know, I just knew I wanted to be off the lockdown unit, and that, I guess that's quantified as willing to go to any length, you know, that was my first experience understanding what that looked like, and I went to my very first meeting, and this little lady sat across that table from me, and she looked like she was about 65, which I think she was probably my age now, and, and, you know, was tore up from the floor up and had a few teeth missing, and she told my story, and she said the things that nobody else said out loud, and, you know, she had talked about the stuff that I had already done, and I was 13 years old, And I absolutely knew unequivocally that there was no hope for me. I was never going to make it out of that. I knew that I would survive this thing. I wouldn't be lucky enough to end up dead. I wouldn't be lucky enough to end up in prison. I would survive this thing, and I would be 65 on a street corner trying to pimp my ass, and nobody would want it. And now I knew that that was my destiny. Talk about lot in life, you know, I heard that that's where I was going to go. And she shared the stuff that nobody else said, you know, and I needed to hear it, and it was the first time that I ever identified outside of my little world. You know, it talks in the big book about every alcoholic believes their life is the only normal one, and I was not stupid. I was actually quite smart. I knew the little girl down the street from me with the little two ponytails didn't live the way that we lived, you know. I knew that her family didn't do the stuff that my family did, and, but I really believed that my life was the only normal one. And, you know, I grew up in this big family. There's four siblings, including me. We're French, we're Italian, we fight, we eat, we drink, we cook, we, you know, like, all that stuff. And we'd have big Sunday dinners, you know, and it was some of the best time in my life. And these people were from wealthy, educated families, and they were alcoholic, you know, and they were doomed to a disease of hopelessness, that there is no out, you know. And I didn't know what to call that. I didn't know what that was when my dad did the stuff that he did, or how he acted, or my mom did the crazy that she did on her little Al-Anon bender, you know. It just was the same crap but without a drink on it, you know. And I didn't know what that was, but I knew that it was like something was off. And being in an alcoholic family with all alcoholic siblings, I still felt different. But I did, you know, and they were all nutbags. But they, you know, I'm the only one they called evil, you know, like that. I mean, apparently I was a little different, but nevertheless, I felt different, you know, all the same stuff that everybody talks about, and you hear, you know, every time you come to a meeting and somebody shares that stuff. I just did, and I knew that it had to do with my insides later. I found that out later, you know, my insides, and, I didn't know that it was spiritual malady. I didn't know that that stuff that I was trying to fill a hole with something, you know, big black hole with the wind blowing through. They used to talk about that a lot when I was new in sobriety, and I didn't know that that's what that stuff was. But I got into that institution because I had a little problem with society, and it's so funny, my five-year-old now does the bunny ears. But I was put in that institution because my sister, that same sister, told, and as she came packing cocaine in her bra to visit me, you know, and I went into that place, and it was the first time in my life that I thought there was a possibility that something could be different for me, and I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't know what that meant, but it was just, I just thought something could be different for me. And I really believe in the magnitude of hope for people like us. But I also think hope can be deceiving, because if it's not followed by some willingness and then action, you're screwed. Like, you know, like hope for a Mercedes Benz. Keep hoping, and that's what happened for me. I got some hope, and I got a sponsor, and I did an inventory, and it went something like this: it's them, I wouldn't have if they hadn't. The end. And if you get out of my way, everything would be fine. Which didn't work out so well for me, you know. I went to that same sponsor and I said, I'm an addict, not an alcoholic. Because I didn't know any 12-year-olds that were slamming coke. I was. But I didn't know any 12-year-olds that were doing that. And she said, that's great, step up to four. Try some controlled drinking. And I thought, oh, that's an excellent idea. Why didn't I think of that? I said, well, I'm not going to use drugs because I'm an addict, not an alcoholic. Well, it didn't matter that booze was always there. If I could have mainlined booze, I would have. I just didn't know anybody that did that until I got sober, you know? So I did, and I spent about a year and a half dry time, and I have to tell you, during that time, you know, I have to say I'm so grateful for that period of my life, because I know what it's like to be without alcohol and drugs and without a program. And I am far more dangerous without a program in between that sets me apart from you and me apart from the booze, you know, 12 steps between me and that next drink. I am so dangerous. Like, far more dangerous than I ever was drinking or using, ever, because I'm just one big black hole with the wind blowing through it, filled with character defects, and I really like to share. I'm not shy or nervous. I'm self-centered. There's a difference. So I'm grateful for that time. Unfortunately, there was harm created during that period, but I am grateful for that time. Because I just don't ever want to be that alcoholic either. You know, I don't I look back at my drinking and my using, and I don't ever want to be that woman, you know, that young girl, and I don't ever want to be that dry alcoholic. It doesn't mean that I haven't gone through the ebb and tide of sobriety and been filled with self and, you know, all those things. I absolutely have, but, and I love that. I heard a lot of, like, just the real deal share here about what it's like today, you know, and what people are going through. Stone cold sober, that this is what this is. I couldn't have made it if everything was, like, fabulous. I couldn't have made it if it wasn't just exactly what it was and that people didn't talk about what really happened then and now. You know, and people do, the people that I want what they have shared about what's really going on with a lot of time, you know. And because it's not, this isn't about it getting narrower. Sometimes it gets so broad that I don't know what the hell to do, you know, let alone all the other stuff and the layers, you know, of the onion or whatever, like, and spiritual malady. Like, I don't deal a lot with the obsession to drink alcohol today. I don't deal with that, the compulsion, ever, because I don't drink today. But I deal with spiritual malady on a daily basis. And that's why I'm here. And why I keep coming back. I went out and I decided that I was going to drink, and the day went like this, you know, it was the same stuff. It was just it wasn't about like hitting just another gnarlier bottom. It was, the bottoms were always the same, just the face changed, that's it. Just who was on the other side of the dish of my crazy was just changed, you know. And I decided to drink casually at 16, or I was 14, I guess, you know. Step up to the bar, okay. I was living in Indianapolis at the time, and I went to whatever the race is there, and I proceeded to do a litany of mind-altering chemicals, ta-da, and got so sauced that I woke up in another part of town, someplace that I didn't know, bloody, bruised, stabbed with some weird dude, and didn't know how I was going to get back or where I was, and I thought that was a good plan, you know, like, and that's how my drinking went, and I proceeded to think that was a good idea for another year and a half, and I decided to do that all over the country. I thought that I was, like, artsy, really smart, because I had gotten into I had an 8th grade education when I got here, no, 7th grade, excuse me, education when I got here, but I had gotten accepted into a prestigious art school college when I was really young, and because I tested well, you know, tested well, and I thought that I was really artsy, and I was just homeless all over the United States, and I would go to those siblings, you know, that were still practicing alcoholics. One had gotten sober in the same year that I got sober the first time, 1986, and she stayed, and the other two weren't sober yet, and they just kind of stopped until they would make the scary phone calls to our codependent mother, who had had just a foot in Al-Anon enough to know that she could save me and got two life insurance policies on me, and just and just a foot out. I remember when she told me that, I was like, I might owe you a pet for around that, but she. And then just a foot out to send me the plane ticket on the last big bender. And I went, you know, all over the country, and I was in California because this was my home, and I always thought that would fix it, you know, no matter where I was, if it was New York or Georgia or whatever, I'd always try to end up back here because I thought that would fix it. And of course, like, as it goes, you know, I brought me with me. And they all said go. Like, every single one of the siblings said go, and all the other people said, go, you gotta go. And I called the mom, and she sent me the plane ticket. I got off the plane, I went to a friend's house, got sauce, went home, OD'd, and died. Slit my wrist and died. Because she didn't, like, I think it was something, like, the trigger was she wouldn't lend me a dress or something. I was like, that's it! You know, like, I'm dead with you! And then I go... you know, she obviously found me and took me to the hospital, and that was where I started this sobriety. And there was a woman that intervened. She had counseled my family on and off over the years, and because we were all jacked up. I mean, we were just all jacked up, and a lot of damage, a lot of other stuff outside of just alcoholism that went down in our family. And she said to me, "I'll stand between you and the courts if you go back to Alcoholics Anonymous and you come see me 3 times a week. And I was out of bullets. I didn't have anything left. There wasn't any place else to go. My beautiful sister, who's my very best friend, who is 18 months, we're 18 months apart in age and then 6 months apart in sobriety, you know, wouldn't have spit on me to, you know, put me out if I was on fire. Nobody was talking to me. And there wasn't anything left. And this lady was a smart cookie. You know, one more time they're telling, you know, they're going through the, well, we're going to put her in this institution and we're going to send her over here and then maybe we'll go, you know, do this. And I had said all the diagnosis, you know, like any 13-year-old that's done any amount of cocaine or alcohol and or other, you know, substances could be diagnosed with all the stuff I had. I had bipolar and multiple personality disorder. Really? Yeah. Yeah, I do. And all kinds of craziness. So I had OD'd on those meds that they gave me. So I jacked myself up pretty good. I couldn't speak in full sentences for the first 6 months of my sobriety. I couldn't write, couldn't read, couldn't articulate a sentence. Nothing. And my way of learning communicating with you was started with F and ended with you. And that was if I liked you. I just didn't have any social ability or any of that stuff. And I was punk rock and it was the 80s. Thank you. So it was real punk rock. I have purple mohawk. It was not a safety hawk. And I was packing at all times, you know, my big leather jacket. But I still have, which is so funny because my 10-year-old found it, like, in the back of the closet. And he's like, "Who's is that?" I was like, "Get the devil out of your eyes!" <I'm> like, <"Hit it!" laughs> But so you know, and I had bathed for a really long time. I had brushed my teeth. Like I just didn't do any of that stuff. You know, like I just didn't know. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't clean up fast. God bless you if you clean up fast. You know, like I didn't clean up fast. I see somebody that knows me in the back of the room laughing at that. Yeah, I did not clean up fast. It was a long road for me. You know, I was not okay. I was not well, and it took a long time. And I didn't get what you guys were talking about with this God of your understanding and all that stuff. I didn't have a bunch of prejudice. I had gone to Catholic school. But none of it resonated with me. It had nothing to do with being mad at it. I wasn't mad at it. If the nuns were mean, it was because they were mean. I didn't like take that out on God. Like, and I didn't all the stuff that I should have been jaded and bitter and all, you know, resentful at around my life and what had happened to me. I didn't think that was God's fault. Just nothing resonated. Nothing connected with that, and so I had a really hard time with that. You know, and I went through the first couple of years of my sobriety believing that my sponsor could believe. You know, and I got this first sponsor, and her name was Tila, and she was big, bad, and leather clad. And she'd come in her wife beater. She was like 6'2", and she would come in her wife beater to the meeting. His name was Charles Manson Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a church basement with some treatment kids and me. And she come to that meeting, and I think she had 5 years, because I found, anyway, long story, but at that time, I think she had 5 years, and she was, like, the only person on the planet that I was afraid of, and she'd every time sit, like, right in front of me, and she'd say, put the plug in the jug, you know, you won't get drunk, and all this stuff, you know. And I finally asked her to be my sponsor, and, you know, like, and she was like, she said, I said, I really just need someone to be kind to me. And she said, that's nice, but you asked me to be your sponsor. And you will read the big book on the toilet because it's the only place you're humble, you know. There you are. I beat her out. Don't hurt me. But she, you know, I didn't know that her day job, she was like a VP of a Fortune 500 company. Like, you know, I didn't go to the noon meeting, so I didn't see her in her little suit, you know. I just saw her at the Charles Manson meeting at night when she sit right in front of my face, and they weren't liking it. You know, I mean, I absolutely believe that things evolve, you know, and that God has an ultimate plan. As judgmental as I am about that at times, like, I really get it that he's got this thing covered and really doesn't need my help, thanks. But things change, you know. If I had been, you know, patted on the ass and like, really, keep coming back, it's so crazy, you know, I would have died and taken a few of you with me, you know. I didn't need that. I didn't need the revolving door theory, you know. It wasn't for me. And I know today that there are some people, or women, I guess, in Alcoholics Anonymous that might need a little squishy, you know, huggy, shuggy. They don't come to me for sponsorship, but they do need that. And I met a couple of those women along my path, you know, that if they had been talked to the way that I was, they would have melted away into a puddle of mush. You know, they needed something else. And that's okay. The 12 steps are the same, no matter how they're played. And I'm grateful for that. I'm really grateful that they did that because, you know, my ego was so big. One of the little gals here asked me, do you get nervous? And it's like, I don't get nervous. I get self-centered. I get into the, what are you thinking of me? I'm thinking about what you're thinking of me. I decided what you're thinking of me. You're judging me. I'm judging you for judging me. I go there. I don't get nervous. You know, I just get consumed. To the power of prayer, you know, like I absolutely ask God, like, just, you know, like, just speak through me. If somebody that they identify with, you know, right on. And if they don't, oh well, I get to think over another hour. But yeah, so I asked her, we started the process of the steps. She had this best friend that was nice, and she wasn't, and I didn't know they were best friends, so I called the nice one, whined at her, and she hang up on me, or say, call central office, that's what they're for, and hang up on me. I didn't know they were friends, and they talked about me, you know, I didn't know all that, I figured that out later. And then I moved back to California. I was in Indianapolis at the time. I spent the first 18 months of my sobriety there, moved back to California, and then that's where I really woke up. You know, I was still pretty sick for those first couple of years, and doing a lot of the same stuff in the rooms that I had done on the streets, you know. And I didn't hear a lot of that talked about. Like, I was addicted to the lifestyle. I was hooked on that. And people didn't talk about that as much. You know, they told me don't bend over in front of my husband, but they didn't tell me, like, the other part of all that stuff, you know. Like, they didn't tell me all that stuff. I didn't hear it as much, but I was hooked to the lifestyle, you know. And it wasn't about, like, learning how to have fun in sobriety and, like, be a, you know, relatively good human being. It was about, like, I didn't know how to stop doing the disease actively in the room, you know. And I saw this lady around, and I just kept seeing her, and she kept saying this stuff to me, you know, and she just always read me like the cheap novel I was, you know, and she'd say the stuff to me, and I just hated that. I hated that she could see it on me, and I, you know, see her everywhere I went, you know, and I just finally, I asked five other women to be my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they all said no. I'm like, that's unheard of. Like, who does that? I know why they did that, but they all said no, and I went to her, and I finally was just like, I surrender, you know, fuck it, be my sponsor, you know. Like, she was like, I've been waiting for you, And I was so, she had everything that I wanted. She was elegant and eloquent and this beautiful, wonderful, like, grand dame. And she was just this awesome human and was of service and had a bazillion sponsees, and her daughter had gotten sober really, really young. And, you know, she would lilt. My sister and I laugh about her, like, lilting across the room. And she's like, well, dear, just pray for him until he's not a bastard anymore, you know? I just loved that and hated that she would tell me the truth, you know, but I just needed it so bad. And her name was Mary Shields Gordon, and I sat on her couch for the first 3 years of my, well, after I moved out to California, first couple of years after that of my sobriety, and I would just say, I don't get it. I would see this sparkly thing in all of your eyes, you know, that thing that happens when you find a power greater than yourself. And you have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. You see that thing that happens to us, and you know, you don't know what that looks like unless you've experienced it. You know, and I didn't know what it was, but I saw it, and I wanted that. And I asked her to help me, and we would sit on her couch, and I would talk to her about how I didn't get it. I didn't get the God thing. It didn't resonate with me, and I felt like a big freaking black hole. But sober, oh, this is great, you know, like, what's the point, you know, but I just couldn't ever go back to that girl, you know. I didn't know what this was, but I couldn't be that girl, and she said to me the thing that I've heard many, many sponsors say, and I've said to other women that I've sponsored. She said, believe that I believe, and all you need is a mustard seed of faith, you know, that's it, to make your beginning, and let's just go through the process of the steps, you know. What does powerless mean? And we went through that process and we started to look at what that really meant. It wasn't, I didn't get it when people said, I'm an alcoholic. Like, who cares? Like, whatever, you know, party began, unmanageable. I didn't care, you know. So, it didn't mean anything, but saying I was powerless over alcohol was a whole different ballgame. Like, that meant that I couldn't do anything about it. I was doomed to drink no matter what I did. I was going to drink no matter what I did, even going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doomed. And it does use the word doomed in the big book, underlined, doomed, you know. It was powerful language, and so we looked at that stuff, and it was the first time that I really got it. Like, I really clearly could not change my reality. There was nothing that I could do that was going to really impact that, or make it, you know, an impact. And that I was going to have to find this power, even if that meant, you know, initially the power of the group, if it meant believing that my sponsor believed, because I watched her life. That's all that mattered to me. It didn't matter what anybody said. I'm a show me girl. Like, show me. Actively do it in your life, and then we'll talk. Like, you know, and I hold myself, unfortunately, to that same standard, you know, which sometimes is very binding, you know. But I did. I laid on that couch and I believed that she believed, and I went through the process of the 12 steps, and I, you know, I got to fly back to that mother of mine that had the one foot in and one foot out, you know, and I didn't tell you that I also tried to kill that woman when I was a year sober. I was institutionalized again when I was a year sober, you know, and because I was mad at her. And I didn't know amends were coming for that, you know. And I got to fly back to Indianapolis and sit face to face with her, you know, and try to take that burden off of her, that, you know, of what I had done. And it didn't matter what she did. It's all that mattered was trying to remove even a piece of that burden from her. And, you know, we went through the process of the 12 steps, and I really started to have a spiritual awakening as a result. And for me, it just had to do with action, you know. It was not about, I had had the Bill Wilson, like, in the hospital, died, went to talk to God. He's like, you can stay or you can go, whatever, you know. And then I had that experience, but I didn't have the awakening until I went through that process. And that was when my life started to shift, you know. It started to change. And for me, I when I went through the process of the third step, the thing that stood between me and God, and the thing that I was asked that was posed to me is, what is it that stands between you and God? And I thought that it was going to be something really important. You know, I had been abused, or I had been whatever it was, or I prostituted myself for drugs and alcohol when I was 12 years old, or all the litany of other things that could have stood between me and God. And it wasn't. I was terrified of being mediocre. Just being in the middle. Just being average, you know. Like, I thought it was going to be really important, you know. Not so much, you know. Same stuff, same self-centered fear, same self. Fear, self, fear, self. And it just, that was the first time when I could really look at that stuff and I got down to it, like, that I not like I acknowledged the basis of this disease and how it's just self. It's the same stuff that it talks about in the big book. It's not really interesting and deep. It's just self. And that the only thing that was going to save me was to have that removed and to be able to be of service to you guys. And that was it. And, you know, honestly, you guys, like, throughout all of the stuff that I've been through in sobriety, and I've been through a lot of stuff in sobriety, because it's life on life's terms, you know. This is, nobody promised me that I'd get anything but that. They said, you get a big bowl of it. You know, you're going to get life on life's terms. And it's been really real. But I've never left. I've never left. I haven't had to have a drink one day at a time, and the 12 steps work, you know. I haven't done anything necessarily that much different than I learned in the first 90 days of my sobriety. People taught me basically all the same stuff that applies now. You know, work with others, clean house, you know, be of service, all that stuff, and continue to trust in God. But I didn't say that I practiced all that stuff in the first 90 days, but it was the stuff that I learned, and none of that stuff has changed for me. It's all been the same stuff, you know, all these years. It does, you know, I don't always know how to apply it, though. I mean, I've gone through different stages. It's like I had to go back to school. I had a woman in my life. Her name was Becky, and she was my sister's sponsor. And we were, you know, she was our adopted mom for a while there because we just hated our mom. And the best thing that I could do was go back and make amends to that woman and then be across the country from her. And that was the depth of our relationship for many, many years. And for me, that was giving her peace and me time to get some recovery under my belt. And, you know, so I adopted this mommy in sobriety, and she was kind of mean, and she told me the truth. But she also said and did the things for me that I couldn't do for myself, you know, and that I was still trying to find a God to rely on to direct me intuitively, you know. And she said to me, you will go get your GED, and I would like the paperwork in my hand by Monday. You know, and I didn't want to cross her. and so I did. I got that paperwork, and I was, you know, had it in her hands by Monday. And then I got to go back to college for a while. And then I decided that I was going to move to L.A. when I was 19 because I had high hopes of whatever it was at the moment. And and I moved down to L.A., and it was weird for a while. You know, I got sober in this group that, you know, they were service, and they, you know, they did a deal, and I went to a couple of meetings on the fringe of the ocean that weren't, it wasn't like that, you know, and it was weird, and they didn't do it right, and I didn't get it, and I called that sponsor, and I'd say, they're not doing it right, you know, like, I don't understand what's going on here, and she'd go, what are you contributing? Click. And then I'd go to that same meeting, and I'd sit on my hands, and I'd try to be of service. And she was the same woman that said to me, you will go to institutions because you were institutionalized. And I, you know, failed to tell you that I was institutionalized one more time after that time in my first year of sobriety when I turned two. And she said, that's where you've come from, so you will do that. You will go to L.A. County Hospital because you deserve to be there, if not in prison. And you will go to Young People's and you will participate in Young People because you're young, you know. And you will go to women's meetings and you will participate in women's meetings because you are a woman, you know. And so I did what she said. I started doing H&I in California, and I started going first down to L.A. County Hospital, and I'd go into that ward, and I'd hit that smell, and it would hit me like a ton of bricks. It smelled like burnt flesh, and I don't know if any of you have ever smelled burnt flesh, but I have. in a big way, and it would make me pass out. I'd hit the floor, and the people on the panel would pick me up, and we'd go do our service, you know. Anyway, and I stayed sober like that, you know. We go to the young people stuff, and I learned more about the traditions in young people in Alcoholics Anonymous bidding for the Los Angeles Convention in the early 1990s than I did anywhere else in my sobriety as of to this day, and I've done a lot of different kinds of service because it's all jacked up. And there's always an old timer on the panel that, you know, or on your committee, or there should be, that, you know, kind of steers it down that path, like a group conscience, and that God is the ultimate authority, not us, you know, and that stuff. And I love that. I love learning about that stuff. I did high school here. You guys were my high school. I never did any of that stuff. I was scared of it. I didn't understand you. I thought you were different, and you knew all that stuff, you know, and had done high school, and I didn't know any of that stuff, you know. I was fist fighting in parking lots. I didn't, you know, like, I was dressed in pink and missed my phone, you know. Like, I didn't do that, so I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, I wanted that. I wanted a lot of that stuff, but I didn't know how to do it. So I learned all that stuff, you know, and I went through the relationships, you know, and I saw him, I'm not kidding, I saw him out there smoking and across the room. Figured I would dance with him that night. I had a few of those. And when I was about 9 years sober, I hit my bottom in Al-Anon with that. And I went to Al-Anon and worked with 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because after I forgot to tell you, that first sponsor had remarried a man that she had married before in sobriety, and that guy went to prison for the rest of his life, and she remarried him while he was in prison. And I thought, how did you ever do that? And then when I was about 8 years sober, there I was. I was a plastic case first. I went to prison. My man. It was hot. And I had a beautiful little guy, and you know, he just can't stay sober. He just can't. And I don't know what that is for him, but he can't stay sober. And every day I pray for him, I pray for his peace, and that he is unafraid. Because for us, that's the best that we can hope for when we're that person, you know. And I have this 10-year-old little guy, and he's like, he's just this rock'em sock'em little dude. He's totally my karma. He's just a pain in the ass. He's like so brilliant and so cunning and baffling and powerful sometimes. You know, and he's just bright and full of life and stuff, and he's just going through it right now. He's been suspended 2 times in the last 2 months. I mean,
right.
And, you know, and it's just, I called my sponsor and I was terrified. I'm like, he's doomed, you know, like, he's doomed in this life, you know. And like, she was like, wait. She goes, tell me what, you know, like, run it down for me. So I ran it down, and what had happened and what he's kind of, you know, rocking right now. And she goes, wait a minute. She goes, he's being 10. She goes, alcoholics act 10. That's why it looks familiar. Right. Well, so he's not Jesus. You know, I don't know. I pray for him every day. I pray that he is peaceful and unafraid, you know. And I met this man in sobriety, and it was one of those things where, you know, oh, 5 minutes, thank you. And it was one of those things where he and I had met years before, and we're pals, just kind of fringe pals in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, nothing, you know, visual about it, just kind of pals. And one of our mutual friends ended up living with him for a period of time, and they were in a car driving to a young people's convention in Seattle, Washington, and somebody popped in one of my CDs, and our mutual friend said, "Oh my God, that's Allison, where is she?" And then we ended up all finding each other after years and years and years, and then he went, "Hey, you guys should date." Instead of being attracted to the girl across the room, you know, like, why don't you date? And so we did, and we, you know, fell in love and had another little baby boy who's just exactly like the first one, but his karma. And he's totally scrappy too, and I'm, you know, just waiting for his fifth fight on the bus, you know, whatever. But he's, they're just these bright, awesome little dudes, and, you know, and this guy and I, like, we've gone through it. We've been sober, you know, it's like, make no mistake, we're sober alcoholics, but we're sober alcoholics, you know. We neither of us come from the, you know, the pinnacle of, you know, family union, you know, we're both kind of jacked up in that area and have worked a lot of things out in our lives, but we've gotten to show up in sobriety with these, with this family, and we're like polar bears, you know. I call my sponsor and I'm like, we're like freaking polar bears. I mean, we're just like eating seals everywhere we go. You know, wily little, like, and she's like, "That's awesome, that's you." Like, be the polar bear, you know. Embrace the polar bear. What's the steps on it? You know, and we just do, and it's just good stuff. And I have this big rich life. You know, I told you in the kind of the end of the share is I had a seventh grade education when I got here. I got offered to run a media company at the beginning of the year. You know, and I get to have this job and do this thing, and they act for me. And it's really scary. It's really hard. And that's what I mean by, you know, that road sometimes gets really wide. It gets really big and really wide. And I related to it, if they only knew, you know. Like, I'm sitting at the board table with these guys that have gone to Harvard, you know. And they're not listening to what I have to say. And that gets scary sometimes. I told you about the self. Remember that? Imagine that in a boardroom. You know, like, are you thinking about me? I'm judging you. You know, like, but I have a God of my understanding today that, like, where is that a little bit? And I get to show up here every single day. And I still sponsor women and I'm of service. And nothing has changed. I wouldn't have it any other way. As hard as it's been, I wouldn't change anything about my life in sobriety. So grateful to be here. So grateful to be sober. Thanks for listening. Give some sweet AA loving to Allison and Corn for speaking tonight. This next line is in bold.